Hello. Is it on? Hello.
I think this mic is actually not working yet. He said there's something wrong with the cord. So I think right now we're going to be micless for.
Okay.
So I apologize about that.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming tonight. We'd like to thank Dr. Eichmann for taking time out of his schedule to come speak to us this evening about such an important topic. Rabbi Dr. Edward Eichmann is an Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine and Associate Professor in the Division of Education and Bioethics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine of Yeshiva University, where he teaches Jewish medical ethics. He received his rabbinic ordination from Reitz of Yeshiva University and writes and lectures internationally in the field of Jewish medical ethics. He is the recipient of a Kornfeld Foundation Fellowship and has been a member of the advisory boards of the Institute for Genetics and Public Policy, the New York Organ Donor Network, the Halachic Organ Donor Society, and the Rabbinical Council of America. His research is devoted to the interface of medical history and Jewish law. Rabbi Dr. Eichmann has been a mentor for the Yeshiva University Student Medical Ethics Society since its inception in 2005. I just like to say that after the event, we're having bone marrow swabbing outside, so before you leave, check it out if you haven't been swabbed. And without further ado, Dr. Eichmann.
Thank you very much. Thank you all very much. We'll just pretend that this microphone is working. It's actually not. It's a tremendous pleasure always to address the Medical Ethics Society. I have a continued love affair with the Medical Ethics Society since the inception of the Medical Ethics Society. For those of you, how many people here, is this a first event for you for the Medical Ethics Society? Okay, awesome, excellent, a lot of firsts. So hopefully the first of many. Without bragging, I would probably say that the Medical Ethics Society is the best society here on campus at Yeshiva University. The objective, many objectives of this society, but it truly typifies the ideals, the philosophical ideals of Yeshiva University more so than any other society. It's the ideal, real, true Torah Umada. Torah Umada not only in the philosophical sense, in the halachic sense, but in the practical sense. As Esti said, I want to thank Esti and the Yitzchak and all the others that were involved in coordinating today's event. Thank you all very much. They said that outside there's the bone marrow swab, which we're going to be talking a little bit about bone marrow donation. But if you do nothing else today, if you don't listen to a single word that I say, you make sure that either on your way in or on your way out, you make sure to get swabbed, and it will be completely worth it for you to have been here today, and for absolutely no other reason whatsoever, as we'll talk about in the course of our discussion. What I'd like to do this evening is I'd like to cover some topics related to organ donation, living organ donation, cadaveric organ donation. Does anyone know what cadaveric means? After death, and a very exciting aspect of our presentation is new frontiers in organ transplantation, including selling organs, non-vital organ transplants, the stuff that's been in the news even the last couple days. Some very exciting stuff. I also encourage you, if there's anything that I say or discuss that you don't understand, don't hesitate to interrupt me. And I'd like to do something a little different. Since we're coming up to Purim, we'll do Venahaf Alchu today. I'm going to ask you guys for questions first, and then we'll engage in our discussion. Because what I'd like to do, really my objective is not, I don't have a particular agenda that I have to get across to you guys that I need to say. My objective really is to get you to understand the topic of organ transplantation, what the medical issues are, and what the halachic issues are. You may not have any questions yet, it's okay if you don't. But if you have any questions, I'd like to hear what your questions are. What did you expect to hear today that you didn't know about or that you thought you knew about? Somebody, come on, yes.
How do you attach an organ to somebody?
Excellent. The technical medical aspects of transplantation. How do you attach an organ to somebody? So we'll talk about that. That obviously depends very much on which organ it is. So, for example, the heart, when the heart is transplanted, they have to sever the great vessels of the heart, and they put the heart in the same place. The kidney, interestingly, when they transplant the kidney, they do not take out the other kidneys. They actually put the new kidney, your kidneys sit in the back of your two kidneys. When they take the new kidney, they put it usually in the pelvis, and they attach it to the vasculature there, because the other kidneys still have some endocrinological function. So it's going to depend on which organ it is. But a lot of it is, you know, is plumbing. You know, you disconnect the pipes and you reconnect it to the new organ. Yes.
In the case of pelvic kidneys, is it considered too much of a risk to donate them, or someone who has a pelvic kidney can donate the other kidney?
I'm saying if you have a pelvic kidney. Yeah. Oh, I see. So that's an interesting question. So some people have their natural kidneys in the pelvis. Would it be a greater risk for them to donate? It may or may not. And one of the things which is clear in the medical field is that when donation does occur, donation is done in such a way to guarantee, not guarantee, there are no guarantees in life, but to assure to the greatest of medical capability that it's a safe procedure for the person to donate. So if there's any concern that the person who donates might develop kidney failure, then they would be hesitant to harvest. Yeah,
you
said.
Are you allowed to put your life at risk for a non-Jew? So if you donate an organ,
So Yosef asked the question, can you put your life at risk to save a non-Jew? Excellent question. Can you put your life at risk to save a Jew? Right? Maybe you can't put your life at risk to save another Jew. So that obviously we are going to discuss. Any other questions? Yes?
Criteria used to establish brain death, and I read a book about like how they didn't, a lot of doctors don't even use that criteria, they kind of just shot away from it.
Excellent. So brain death. So how do you determine brain death? And are there specific criteria? Short answer, and we'll obviously address some of these in the course of our conversation. Short answer is that when the brain death criteria were established, there were specific criteria, but you are correct in the fact that in the application of those criteria, hospitals are not bound by specific criteria, so different hospitals can define brain death differently. So there is a little bit of ambiguity there, but there are specific criteria. Any other questions before we begin our discussion? Can I keep talking while you guys are?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
We're gonna have to switch the podium because you can leave it there. We can put the one next to it.
Okay. Okay. No problem. So let me begin actually with the following case to launch our discussion. Does anyone recognize what this is? This is a newspaper. Okay. It's actually funny because back in the day when I was starting my research a number of years back, when I did research, I actually read the newspapers and I cut out newspaper clippings. You know, I cut out the articles, or I Xeroxed them, and I had paper files, and I had massive amounts of paper files at home, which I'm in the process of converting to scan documents and categorizing. But I'm thinning out a lot of them and throwing out a lot of them. So today I was actually just leafing through my paper file on organ donation, and I pulled this article. It's called Doctors Turn Down Father's Sacrifice of Last Kidney for Son. And this is from a British newspaper from February 19th, 1996. And here's the tragic and fascinating story and dilemma. Cliff Pendergast had two sons who suffered from total renal failure due to a genetic kidney disorder. So he had two sons who developed kidney disease that they inherited from their parents, called Alport syndrome. And he faced an unenviable choice. This father wanted to do whatever he could for his children, wanted to donate his kidney to help his children. The problem was he had two kids who needed kidney transplants, and he has two kidneys, but usually people only donate one kidney. So he was debating, which son do I donate my kidney to? So he actually donated his kidney to one of his children who got sicker earlier in life, but then a number of years later he decided, I want to donate my second kidney to my second son. And he went to the physicians in England and said, take my second kidney so I can transplant my second kidney to my second son, and I will go on dialysis. Do you guys know what dialysis is? Anybody know what dialysis is? What's dialysis? What does dialysis do in essence?
It filters out the toxins going in the blood.
Correct. So it's an artificial kidney. So we actually have, dialysis has been around for a number of decades. We have what's called dialysis, which is an artificial kidney. It's a tremendous luxury. We do not have an artificial liver.
It's ready.
We do not really have. Great. Thank you guys so much. Thank you. We do not have an artificial liver. We do have a form of artificial heart, but it can only last for a relatively short period of time, not for a prolonged period of time, at least not yet. And we do have the dialysis machine, which really in essence functions like an artificial kidney. So he said, let me donate my second kidney to my second son, and I'll go on dialysis. So the question that I have for you guys to introduce our first section, the section of living organ donation, is one, assuming Mr. Pendergast is a Jewish fellow, is it okay, halachically permissible, for him to donate his first kidney to his first son? How many people think yes? How many people think no, can't donate? How many people think he cannot donate that first kidney? So we got one person thinks he can't donate that kidney. Now, what about donating his second kidney? How many people think he's allowed to donate his second kidney? We have one and a hesitant two. How many people think it's usur, forbidden for him to donate a second kidney? So we will see, based on our halachic analysis, what the issue is with this very sad and difficult ethical challenge for Mr. Pendergast. In the field of living organ donation, what organs can one living human being donate to another living human being? Scream out.
Liver.
One lung. A lung, yeah, part of a lung.
Kidney.
Heart. Okay, we're all cheating over here. In the student spirit, I love it. Okay, blood, but these are the organs that can be donated. Blood, now blood you probably wouldn't even mention, a lot of people don't realize that blood is, not only blood is an organ, blood is the largest organ in the body. There's blood, bone marrow, kidney, liver, and lung. Anything else I missed on that list? Skin. Actually, you can donate to yourself skin. You can donate skin to others. More so, skin is donated after death, but can be donated from a living human being as well. So the question is, what are the halachic issues? What's the halachic basis for a discussion about living organ donation? One human being giving an organ to someone else, basically putting their life at risk in order to save somebody else's life. So for the donor, the major issues, and we're going to focus on the donor pretty much today, major issues are chavala, some kind of wounding or bodily harm to the individual, which is a halachic concern. And the second one, which will be our main focus, lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. And that's the pasuk here on the bottom. Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, do not stand idly by when the blood of your brother is being shed. So that really is a tzivui, it's a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah aseh, you know, although it's really formed in a negative fashion, but it's a mitzvah not to stand idly by, a chiyuv, not stand idly by as the blood of your brother is being shed. Now what's fascinating is that the state of Israel, actually very recently, enacted a law in Israel called the Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa law, which requires an individual to intervene if someone is in harm's way. So if you have an accident, for example, it's on the road, and you can easily stop and help that person and you don't, you can be fined according to the Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa law. What's the American equivalent? You know what the American equivalent? Right, the Good Samaritan. Now, the Good Samaritan law is not an obligation on the citizens of the United States. It's merely protection from liability if they happen to stop. But by no means is anybody in the United States obligated in any way, shape, or form to do anything. And I'm sure you guys have seen these classic scenes in New York where people are literally dying or dead on the streets of New York and people are stepping over them. You know, there's horrific scenes like that which take place, you know, pretty much every year in the city of New York, showing that obviously the citizens here don't espouse the Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa law. Although Bloomberg might add it to get a little extra income for the city, in addition to banning 16-ounce sodas. So what is the parameters, or what are the parameters of Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa, and how are they applied clinically to our situation of organ donation? So we start with the Gemara. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says the following. It says, Minayin l'roes chaveru shutovea benar. How do you know that if someone is drowning in the ocean, someone is here in the bottom in the tsunami, oh, chayago rosso, or he's being attacked by a lion from the Bronx Zoo, or listin boinolov, or he's being attacked by robbers, shuchayv latzilo, that you have an obligation to save that person, tamud lomar lo samar odam reyecha. So the Gemara says, hame hacha nafka, Mehasam nafka. There's another source, the Gemara says, that obligates each Jew to save the life of somebody else. And what is that source? V'hashevosalo. And you should restore a lost object to somebody. Now, what is the most precious lost object, precious object that anybody owns? Their body, their health, their life. So you have an obligation to restore that lost object. So the Gemara engages in a discussion about what each one of these psukim would obligate an individual to do. And it comes out in the end that there's really two aspects of the obligation that are covered by both of these psukim. One is a physical obligation for you to jump into the ocean and save somebody. And the other is a financial obligation that you have to save somebody who's at risk. So, for example, they have these people that are kidnapped. And this used to be very common in the Middle Ages when the Jews were kidnapped and they had to be ransomed. Pidyon Shvuim is a classic case of Lo Salmod Al Dam Riecho, and there's a financial obligation both for the individual and for society to save those people. The Shulchan Aruch codifies that obligation for us, based on the Gemara and based on the Rambam. And it says, HaRoes Chaver Tovei Benar, you see somebody drowning, Olistim Boyin Alav, V'yachol La'atzilo, and it says, here's the twofold obligation, Yachol Atzilo Hu Be'atzmo, either you can physically save somebody, O Shiskor Acherim La'atzil, or you can hire somebody else to perform this rescue, then you are obligated to do such a thing. However, what the Shulchan Aruch doesn't say, and is not really helpful for a contemporary 21st century circumstance, doesn't tell us how much risk each person has to accept or incur in order to save somebody else's life. So great, you know, I have an obligation to for myself to physically do it, I have an obligation to spend some money, but if I'm going to be a donor of an organ of my body, I have to figure out how much risk I'm allowed to accept in order to save the life of somebody else. And that's where this the famous tshuva of the Radbaz comes in. The Radbaz, Egyptian Rav of the 16th century, lived pretty much most of the 16th century. And the question that was posed to him, which he answered and in essence set the parameters which have been extrapolated today to contemporary organ donation, is the following case. It's argued whether it's a hypothetical case or it's a case that really transpired, but clearly transpired sometimes, unfortunately many times, in the course of Jewish history. He says, Sha'alta mimeni, odiacha dati al masha ra'isi kasuv, im amar ha'shilton Yisrael, if a dictator or a soldier says to a Jew standing next to another Jew, says, hanach li liktzotz eiver echad she'ein chames mimenu, sorry about that, said, allow me to amputate one of your limbs, and if not, amis Yisrael chavercha, I will kill the Jew standing next to you. What is this individual's obligation? And some say not. So what the Radbaz does in this, and I'll synopsize what the Radbaz established for us. He established, in essence, three categories. Category one is when the rescue that you are about to embark on is relatively minimal risk. In that case, you have a chiyuv of lo samod al dam riecha, and the Torah obligates you to perform that rescue. The other polar extreme is that the rescue involves immense amount of risk to such an extent that you may die in the course of the rescue. Dying in the course of the rescue, to perform that kind of rescue, the Radbaz famously said, you are considered a chassid shote. You're a pious fool. It's an arguable, for our purposes, we'll assume that the Radbaz says it's usser. It's actually prohibited to perform a rescue where your life is going to be lost. Why? What's the reason for that? Because not only do you have an obligation of lo samad al dam riecha, you have an obligation of nishmartim od l'nafsho seichem. You have an obligation of self-preservation, and who's to say that that your blood is any redder than his, or his blood is any redder than yours? That's the second category. The third category, which is the chasm between those two, is the category where the risk is not exceedingly high and not exceedingly low. And in that category, the Radbaz says the individual has the right to decide, volunteer for the rescue or not to volunteer for the rescue. If someone does volunteer for that rescue, they are considered a tzaddik. It's a tremendously laudatory act, but there's absolutely no chiyuv for them to undergo such an act. So those are the three categories of the red bars. Again, category one, obligatory because of minimal risk. Category two, prohibited because of extremely high risk. Category three, voluntary because the risk is not so clearly quantified, it's not so great, it's not so low. So the question is, how do we apply the categories of the red bars to our contemporary organ donation scenarios? So we said that one of the things that we donate is blood. Now, how risky is it to serve as a blood donor? Any ideas? Not very risky. Has anybody ever died giving blood? No, usually not from normal blood drawing, no. At least not the way I draw blood, they're not going to die. So, you know, they may faint. People faint with drawing blood if they don't have their Stelladora cookies. See the Stelladora cookies? They don't use Stelladora cookies anymore with blood drawing anymore. What do they use now? Is there like...
Oreos?
Oh, no, it's Oreos. Okay, so I got to change the picture to Oreos. Now, one thing which is extremely important in all our discussions, in the entire Medical Ethics Society discussions and all our medical halacha discussions, is when you engage in any analysis of a medical issue and you want to render a halachic decision about that medical issue, you must make sure you're dealing with the proper medical facts. And that goes across the board with no exception. So when you say there's no risk, you know, you and I can say there's no risk, but is there genuinely no risk? If scientists look at it, have there been studies that determine that in fact there is no risk? So here you have a study, this is from 2007, complications related to blood donation, a population-based study. All complications were either needle injuries or vasovagal reactions. In the nationwide register, a total of 752 moderate and severe complications were recorded among 2,575,264 donations. How many people have that number of people in their medical studies? 2,575,000 people. So that's a pretty high number and pretty statistically convincing that the risk in blood donation is relatively minimal. So based on the categories of the Red Baz, where would we put blood donation in the category? Which category would we put the blood donation in? The Chiyuv, right? What makes blood interesting is that there is no clear connection between you, the donor, and the recipient, right? So I can't really say that if someone is bleeding or the Red Cross is requesting blood donation, that each one of you specifically is mechuyev to donate blood to them. Now, it's a tremendous chesed, without question. But take the following scenario. You know, let's take a small town. Small town in Europe, and there's one operating room, there's one physician, and there's, you know, maybe a few hundred people in the town, and the physician's operating in the operating room, and he hits the aorta. Now, what happens when you hit the aorta? The blood hits the ceiling, right? So this patient could exsanguinate. This patient could die if they don't get blood. And this patient has AB negative blood, and there's one person in the town who has AB negative blood. Are you allowed to force that person to serve as a donor in American law?
No.
How many people think you can force that person in American law? How many people think no way you can force that person in American law? In American law, basically, nobody has to do anything ever. It's the basic gist of American law. You know, nobody has any obligation to help their fellow man in American law. Now, according to halacha, can you tie this person down and bring him to the hospital and take blood from him? What do you think? So Mordechai says no. So it's actually machlokas, and there's some poskim who say it's not uniformly, it's not unanimous, but there's some poskim that say indeed you can tie this person down and do it. Why? What's the halachic basis? Because he has the ability, first of all, it's not only he as an individual has an obligation to lo samar adam riecha, we as a society have an obligation to enforce this lo samar adam riecha, and the risk to him is so small and the benefit to the recipient is so great, we can tie this person down, bring him to the operating room, and extract the blood from him to save the other person because of that scenario. Now what's interesting is that, let's go to bone marrow donation. How risky is bone marrow donation? Riskier than blood?
Yeah.
Okay, a little more risky than blood. Now here, another extremely important factoid from our discussions. One, we said you have to incorporate the medical knowledge in order to paskin the halacha. Second, which is really a corollary of the first, that the medical knowledge that you're using has to be very current and very up to date because things evolve and things change. So bone marrow donation, years ago, used to be a relatively complicated procedure. You used to have to literally, you know, bore holes into multiple bones to harvest a fair amount of marrow to serve as a donor. So today things are different. Things are different for two reasons. Things are different, one, because you don't need to harvest as much marrow if you're even going to use standard marrow donation. And the other reason is sometimes you can use what's called stem cell donation. Does anyone have any idea what stem cell donation is? Now, stem cells, without getting into an entire discussion about stem cells in halacha, which is itself a fascinating discussion, we all carry within our blood system stem cells, blood-borne stem cells. These are early embryological cells that can reproduce the blood supply, and they can be used to treat people who suffer from different cancers. So rather than harvest from the bone marrow, you can actually harvest from the person's blood stem cells. Now, you need to take medications to make those stem cells accessible through the blood supply. The medications have some limited risks. But as opposed to a bone marrow donation, where they literally have to take a drill and drill into your bone to harvest the marrow from your bone, in stem cell harvest, they would put in a regular needle like they'd be doing a blood draw, and then run your blood through a machine, not dissimilar really to dialysis, and pull out those key stem cells to be able to treat somebody. So based on that, which category do you think stem cell donation and bone marrow donation would be placed according to the Radboz? Chiyuv or voluntary? Now, there's one real fundamental difference here between blood and bone marrow donation. What's that difference? The difference is that whereas blood donation, we said, is nonspecific, there's really no connection between the donor and the recipient because there's millions of people that have every single type of blood supply. In bone marrow donation, it is quite possible, and very often is the case, that if you are a match to an individual, you could literally be the one only match in the entire world on the face of the earth for this particular individual. And if you don't donate to this particular individual, that person might not have an option. And it reminds me actually of a fascinating case, which I'm going to share with you in a minute. So do you think, now we said the case of the blood donation, that according to some posting, you could tie that person down and bring him to the operating room and harvest his blood. Let's say somebody in this room turns out to be a bone marrow donor match. Is that person obligated? Can we coerce that person? Obviously not today in this non-theocratic world, United States, but can you theoretically coerce that person to serve as a bone marrow donor? What do you think?
Wait, why do you say we can't in the United States? I mean, even if it's illegal to coerce them to go up message, doesn't that violate American law? Shouldn't we coerce the person even though it's illegal?
Oh, excellent question. So for cases of pikuach nefesh, indeed, Dina d'Malchuso wouldn't apply. Right, so if it is a pikuach nefesh issue, we could, in theory, force somebody to do that. We don't really have the framework within which to do that. We don't have a Beis Din, we don't really have a framework. No, but each person, it'd be arguable, it'd be a pretty crazy society if each person was tying these people down and bringing them for bone marrow donation. But let me share with you this case, which just comes to mind, which I unfortunately didn't put in the slides, I didn't think of it beforehand. An unbelievably complex and tragic case, which transpired this past year in Eretz Yisrael. And here's the case. Case is, a young woman did a bone marrow drive, similar to the bone marrow drive you guys did, and she ended up being a match for an individual. Now, I have to give you a little bit of medical background before we continue with this. The way bone marrow harvest works is the following. In order for a person to receive a bone marrow donation, you have to eradicate their existing bone marrow. Irradiate and eradicate their existing bone marrow. So in essence, they have no bone marrow at all, and they're in an extremely fragile state, and you do it in such a way that after the bone marrow has been eradicated, you immediately transplant the new bone marrow from that donor into that individual, and hopefully, many times is the case, that person can be completely cured. This was the case. A young woman, much like any woman sitting in this room, in late teens, early 20s, signed up for the bone marrow drive and agreed to be and was found to be a match for a particular individual, and she agreed to go through with the donation. Not only that, she got tested a second time, and it was confirmed that she was an absolute match. The person had a fatal disease, a fatal leukemia, and wouldn't survive without the bone marrow donation. As the process normally continues, the recipient got irradiated, and their bone marrow was destroyed. And they are now waiting for the recipient to give the donation. At that stage, this woman had cold feet and refused to go ahead with the donation. And this is not a fictional case. This is a real case. So you have a person sitting in the hospital with their bone marrow eradicated, faces certain death if this person doesn't donate the bone marrow, and this person decides, for a variety of reasons, I think her parents actually compelled her, they thought it might be a little too risky for her, not to go ahead with the donation. What do you think the halacha would be in that case? Do you think that is different? Would you be allowed to compel her to go through with the donation at that stage? Ah, so from contractual law, is she contractually obligated? Let's say she didn't sign, she just gave her verbal agreement. Yes? But it wasn't that much of a risk for her. Right, you can't sign off to do something which is neged halacha. You can't make a shua against neged halacha, but this isn't that kind of scenario. So let me tell you what happened in this case. The woman, all the gedolim came to visit this woman and tried as best as possible to coerce her to go through with the donation. None of them were successful. At the end of the day, she refused to go ahead with the donation and the recipient died. Unbelievable story. I can't imagine what was going through this woman's mind. So whatever thoughts her parents had about the risk she would undergo with the donation, the psychological damage which was caused her by not donating, I think, is far, far greater and far, far long-standing than they could ever have imagined. The question was asked to a number of gedolim in retrospect, would it have been permitted to force this woman to undergo? Now, in American law, they wouldn't have been able to force her to undergo the donation. Granted, afterwards, they could have sued her in civil court for damages and that kind of thing. But in terms of in terms of coercing her, they couldn't have coerced her. And I think it was trying to remember. It's Chuvas van Hagos or Sternbach. So Sternbach who was asked this question, and he said that it may have been possible to coerce her at that stage in retrospect. Even there, he wasn't even so absolutely clear. But here you have in front of you, so you see that there's real halachic nafkaminas in these kinds of cases. Here you have in front of you an article by Rabbi Bleich, who maintains that it is possible, theoretically, to coerce somebody. He says, so he makes a strong argument that the risk is so small and the benefit is so great that indeed halachically may be able to coerce somebody to serve as an organ donor. A Gift of Life is a phenomenal organization which is behind the bone marrow donation that is running outside Mir Sashem after the event. I don't know the numbers. You guys probably know the numbers better than me, but I think YU has the most amount of successful matches. Do anyone know the numbers, what the numbers are up to these days? The numbers are relatively much, much higher for the YU community than for any other community. Now, Yosef asked an interesting question about the non-Jewish donor versus Jewish donor, recipient rather. Should there be a halachic nafkamina or not? And the answer is that posts can clearly differentiate between the two. And the standard conventional understanding of the obligation of los amar al dam reyecha is reyecha b'mitzvos, your fellow Jew. But having said that, there are many poskim who expand that the principle of donation lifnim yishur hasadin to serve as a donor. And clearly, the potential for kiddush Hashem is extraordinary to save somebody's life in the performance of these kinds of donations. And in fact, in bone marrow donation, it is anonymous. So you don't know who the bone marrow recipient is. You can perhaps meet them, and if you had an opportunity, which I haven't yet had an opportunity to go to the Gift of Life dinners, they actually coordinate the meetings between the donor and the recipient for the first time at the dinners. And for those who have attended have told me it's quite an extraordinarily emotional meeting for the donors and recipient, literally have saved their lives. But as far as the importance of serving as a bone marrow donor goes, there are very few things in your entire life ever. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. There are very few times in your life, even if you go into the fields of medicine, very few times in your life that you can genuinely save another human being. And to save another human being with such little effort to you is the kind of thing that if it comes into your lap, you're found to be a match, you shouldn't pass up lightly. You should think long and hard before you'd ever pass such an opportunity up, because it's really a tremendous, it's a gift. It's a gift of an opportunity to do something which will have meaning for you and your family for the rest of your life. So we talked about, yes?
Sponsored is Elf Mishkan University. Sponsored donors, 4,901. Members recruited, 94. Matches, 264.
264, that's amazing.
Transplants, 40. Total donated, 1,892.
That's great. Kol hakavod. The beauty of internet. I love that. You know, I used to ask, you know, just like I picked up the newspaper before now, it's like when I teach small classes, everyone's got their computers up, it's like questions are all answered within 30 seconds of asking, so it's great. Thank you very much. I personally think, yeah, Mordechai.
Just back to the donating to non-Jews, the posting that allowed by expanding with that, is it something Ava default, or did they actually come up with a positive argument to be able to donate and put yourself at risk?
They come up with the, there's both. There's the whole spectrum. There are those who claim that, understanding of the non-Jew today versus the non-Jew back in the Middle Ages is fundamentally different based on the Meiri and others, and that we have an obligation to be collectively involved in society with people that share our basic values, especially people who believe in monotheistic values, and that there is a positive value in serving as a donor to these other peoples. And there are those who claim it's just a default, and it's really an Ava. It's really an Ava issue, and the whole how Ava plays out in the world of transplantation is not so clearly defined. It's not, it's not as clear as one would think. You know, there are other people that don't donate, for example. So classically, the African American population donates very little, and they are the highest. They have the highest incidence of kidney disease in the black population. Why don't they donate? Any reason do you think why the black community as a whole doesn't donate?
Well, if they're very risk of kidney disease, then they donate one kidney and then they have the other kidney disease, so it makes sense.
Excellent point, but it's not for a medical reason, yes.
Because they're Jehovah's Witnesses, a lot of them are Jews.
Ah, good. So some of them are witnesses, but it's a very small percentage of them are witnesses, and they don't. What's the reason the witnesses don't donate blood, by the way?
They don't believe in medical treatment.
No, it's a biblical interpretation of achilas dam. They believe that injecting in the vein is a form of achila, and that since there's an iser achilas dam, they don't take a blood transfusion. If you ask different poskim amongst the witnesses, they have different pesach halacha about the which blood products are permitted and which blood products are not. I'm sorry. So right. And some hospitals have actually blood substitutes, which can be used. But the reason why the African American population doesn't donate is because the African American population has very bad experience with the white medical community over the centuries, for sure in the recent past in modern American history. So the blacks have been discriminated against. The blacks have been used as guinea pigs in experiments. And they actually believe that they are being. Many of them still believe that the white, predominantly white medical community, it can't be trusted. And there's some famous experiments. I don't know if you. I'm sorry. Yeah. So the Hoffer, Rabbi Hoff, mentions the famous Tuskegee experiments, which was an experiment of predominantly Southern black gentlemen that were afflicted with syphilis. And the objective of the study was to see how syphilis progresses. There's primary, secondary, and tertiary syphilis, and to see the long-term effects of syphilis. In the middle of the study, it was discovered that penicillin was a cure for syphilis, and it was a decision by those running the study not to administer penicillin to this population of patients so they could continue to observe them to see how syphilis progresses. One of the famous terrible experiments, and obviously there are terrible experiments in the Holocaust as well, which make the Tuskegee experiment pale in comparison. Let's return to the issue of kidney donation. So how risky, we talked about blood donation and bone marrow donation. What about kidney donation? How risky is kidney donation?
0.1%
of dollars. So maybe, yeah, right around that. Right around that. Somebody's been reading the medical journal. So I have that up here? I don't have that up here, do I? Okay. So, but there is a fatality rate with kidney donation. And as I mentioned, you have to really take these statistics at the time that you're rendering the PSOC. So for example, back in the 1960s, when kidney donation started, the Tzitz Eliezer said, the kafisha amruli arofim, hotsas kilyo chedome meha yivarim apanimim, afal pishu bari, even though the donor is healthy, karoch bistamba besafik sakana, is dangerous. Which category did he, and he put it into which category of the Radbaz? The Usser category. He said it's Usser to donate a kidney because in the early stages of kidney donation, people were dying. But now we know that things are different. And he even himself says, Elain kein segel chabura shel rofi mumchin yachlitu achrein meduktak shadavar lo karach besafik sakonas nefashos l'manadev. But if doctors say sometime in the future that donation is not so risky, then indeed you would be allowed to donate. It would shift it from the usser category to the mutter category, but not to the absolute mechuyev category, because there is still some risk. Now, the risk of kidney donation is twofold. It's the risk of the procedure. It's a much more serious procedure than blood or bone marrow harvest, because it's an operation involving anesthesia. And secondly, it's the risk of living the rest of your life with only one kidney, which is itself a risk. And as it stands now, the studies reflect that people who live with one kidney, there's two populations that have been studied with one kidney to determine the fact that it's relatively safe. One population, the first population that was studied were the military population, soldiers, who received abdominal wounds, usually gunshot wounds. They required a nephrectomy, the removal of one kidney, and had one healthy kidney remaining. These people have been followed since the Vietnam War for 30, 40, 50 years, and they follow them to see if they have a higher incidence of kidney disease than others. And the second population is actually the very population we're talking about, is the people who've donated kidneys. So you have thousands of people that have donated kidneys since the 1960s. These people have been followed to see if the people that donated kidneys have a higher likelihood of developing kidney failure later on in life. And the answer is maybe a fraction of a percentage, but not in any substantive way that would change the PSOC. So basically, because of that, today, while the Tzitz Eliezer said it was usher back in the 60s, today there's not a single POSIC that says that it's usher to donate a kidney. And in fact, the post can be very encouraging of people who want to serve as a kidney donor. But just a word of caution, lest you think that the risk is completely negligible. I share with you from the hospital that I work at, which is our own institution, Montefiore is the teaching hospital for the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. This is from June of 2012. Montefiore Hospital's renowned live organ donor program has been shut down after the death of a mom on the operating table. And I happened to have not been in the hospital that day, but I came to the hospital the next day, and my colleague shared with me an experience that he had, which made a profound impact on him. As circumstance would have it, this was a mother donating to her daughter a kidney. On the operating table, we talked about before, in a small town, if the surgeon perforates the aorta, and you need to get blood from somebody else. So that's exactly what happened in this case. The surgeon hit the aorta in the course of the operation, and they simply could not control the bleeding, and the woman exsanguinated. The woman died. To add insult to injury, it happened to be National Organ Donor Day. and literally right outside the hospital were hundreds of people that were celebrating the amazing wonders of transplantation in the 21st century. And you know, upstairs, just a few feet away from where they were celebrating, the woman died in the course of a donation. The emergency room gets called for people who are sick within the hospital. So a friend of mine, you know, one of my colleagues got called for a street call, it's called, you know, up on the fifth floor where the operating room was. And he said he had no idea what he was being called for. It was just innocuously going upstairs. It could be anything from, you know, some, a fall to an asthma attack to a heart attack. You have no idea until you get there. He said he thought it was a nuclear holocaust. He got there, and the entire waiting room, which was packed with dozens of family members, were all on the floor, prostrated on the floor, wailing. And he said he'd never, ever seen anything in his life like that. And this was a young, healthy mother who was going to donate a kidney to her child. So as wonderful as organ donation is, and as wonderful as all the aspects of medicine that we practice, there still are real, genuine, and tragic risks in the wonderful work that we do. What's the current state of living organ donation? There isn't a single newspaper that you will pick up, the Jewish Week, the Jewish Press, all the newspapers. If you look, you probably don't even notice them because you're not paying attention to them, but every one of them carries an ad for people who are requesting organ donation. Yes? So there was complications. So the girl, she wasn't in a state where she would require that donation emergently and she would die otherwise. She was on dialysis. So dialysis continued with her, and what happened subsequently is that, to add insult to injury in this case also, Montefiore, trying to do good for her after this terrific tragedy, they actually, the next kidney which was available from a cadaver, they attempted to transplant into her, but the national network of organ sharing stopped them before they were able to perform the operation because they said she doesn't meet the criteria of being next on the list in terms of medical severity. So it was a terrible, terrible thing. You know, they were just trying to rectify the situation quickly, get her another kidney, and rescue some positivity in this circumstance. But as fate would have it, it's just what it wasn't meant to be. And that really is genuinely true. With a living donation, you can donate to anybody you want. The person could be relatively healthy and just need a kidney. But with cadaveric donation, there's a list, and there's a hierarchy, and there's a triage protocol about who receives a kidney and who doesn't receive a kidney. So that was just a horrific circumstance. So I encourage you to pay attention to these newspapers now that you know about this. You will see in every newspaper every single week requests like this. If you are O positive or whatever blood donation, blood type you are, etc., etc. This is another case. And there's a fascinating case here, which I'll share with you, which I'm sure I've shared with some of you before. I actually have the safer here. It's called Kloios Yoetzos, which I picked up just surreptitiously in Flatbush. You know, it's somebody dropped off a couple of copies. It's a self-publication book, and the entire book is one Shaila, and the Shaila was a Chaver Knesset who needed a kidney donation, and as it turns out, his doctor said a living donation would be better than a cadaver donation. And the man had five sons. So he came home from the doctor, and one of his sons was at home. And he said, you know, Abba, where have you been? He said, I went to the doctor, and the doctor said I could really benefit from a living kidney donation. So the son immediately, you know, took a bus to Hadassah Hospital and had himself tested. When the son comes back, you know, to his home at night, the other four brothers are there. And they said, oh, Chaim, what you been up to? He said, well, I just went to the hospital to get tested so I can be a donor for Abba. So he said, what do you mean? Who says you have the right to be a donor to Abba? We want to donate a kidney to Abba. And the Bechor said, I'm the Bechor, I'm the firstborn, I not only have obligations, I have rights which you don't have. And I get to be the donor to Abba. So they had absolutely no idea how to solve this. You know, they fought tooth and nail, or kidney in this case, to be able to benefit their father. and thanks a lot, to be able to benefit from it. So how do you solve this dilemma? How do you think they solve the dilemma? Any ideas, wild ideas? So they actually asked, it doesn't say here, it doesn't say anywhere here who the posik was. Turns out that the posik was Rav Elyashiv. It was just Nifter this year. How would you solve this dilemma? Any wild ideas? Yes. Ah, good. So first you ask the medical question. Which one was a good match? I'll make it hard for you. They're all a good match. Ah, so good point. The one who came up with the idea first. And you have a suggestion? Oh, good. So another medical, but assume again, I'll make it hard for you. They're all good kidneys and they all last the equivalent amount of time. Yari.
Age,
I'll give you the same, I'll answer you the same way. So here's the answer. What? So it's part of it is your answer actually, that the there is a halachic principle kol hamaschil b'mitzvah omrim lo gemor. So the first person who tested himself had a leg up, or in this case a kidney up, from the other guys. But Rav Elyashiv said the bechor also has an advantage over the others. So how are you going to decide between the bechor and the first person who tested? Any ideas? So he did a raffle. Actually, he did a raffle between those two, and the Bechor won. And the Bechor served as a kidney donor, and he lived a number of years. Actually, it was just Nifter about a year or two ago. It was Chavar Knesset. So that pretty much. Now, what about the other forms of living donation? We covered blood. We covered bone marrow. We covered kidney. What about liver and lung? So liver is a little more complicated, the donation. And in fact, a number of people died donating livers. Back in 2002, I don't know if I have that here. Mount Sinai, in 2002, there was a death in Mount Sinai in the live liver donor program, and they closed down the liver donor program because of it. But data is accumulating that liver donation is becoming more and more safe. So now people are beginning to donate more livers, and post-chemo are beginning to make that an acceptable risk and not a prohibited risk in the usher category. I'm going to spend just a few minutes actually on cadaveric donation, just because Medical Ethics Society has had a lot of discussion about brain death and this kind of thing. I just want to give you some very major simple overview of that, and then I want to shift into the new frontiers, which is an exciting, very exciting aspect. So before we leave living organ donation, any questions on living organ donation that you guys want answered? Yes.
Is there a percentage that
excellent question. The application of statistics to these Piskei Halacha. The one aspect which still is somewhat ambiguous is very detailed statistical analysis. So Poskim use mute and mute hamatsui and rov. How you define a mute? Some say 5%, some say 10%. Mute hamatsui is there's really no absolute consensus. Rav Schechter has written about this in a number of his essays, and if you're interested in more analysis, I'm happy to share with you a number of articles which discuss the halachic principles of application of statistics. But it's not a consensus that this is clearly 5%, 10%, or 15%. In terms of rove, even rove is not so clear, but rove, obviously, the simple rove is 51%. What do the Radbaz mean that it has to be fatality? Does that mean, 51%? Or, a 30% fatality, we would consider a tremendously high fatality. So all those are taken on a case-by-case basis. Yes, in the back. So the question was, what if the parents veto the donation? So the answer is, if the person is an adult, and in this case, adult halachically defined as a bar mitzvah or a bas mitzvah, that person does not have to listen to their parents in terms of donation. They have the right to make that their own donation. However, if you have someone who is married and their spouse vetoes the donation, there are poskim that give veto power to the spouse because it impacts on the spouse. It impacts on the physical relationship of the spouse. It impacts on the ability of the spouse. You know, it has to take time off and be in the hospital. So there are those who would give veto power to a spouse. So the point is well taken. Yeah, Ari, did you want to ask others? Yes.
So another question was percentage. Even if poskim are not willing to discuss percentages, figure out a percentage based on what poskim say. Like, poskim always say that whenever there's a 1% chance that it's fine, then that means that it's 1%.
Yeah, I mean, the poskim do invoke percentages. They do use the miut, and they do explicitly say what they consider the miut, which percentage they consider the miut. But it's sort of a moving target. It's a moving target. And the problem is, even if a posik says 10%, how do you apply that? You know, do you use one journal study here, you know, from the New England Journal, when next week there'll be another study which has a different statistic? And how many people do you require in your study group in order for that statistic to be valid? So posik says 10%. If your study group has 50 people, is that sufficient enough to say 10% for that posik is a miut amatzai, or does it have to have, you know, like that study about blood donation, you know, 2,555,000 people? You know what I mean? So it eludes to a certain extent real clarification. So the post can really decide on a case by case basis based on their gestalt and based on their perception of statistics. Yes.
I see cumulative percentage. Both surgical complication and aesthetic complication.
Right, so is it additive, is it multiplicative, right, so how are you going to incorporate these statistics? So there's the risk of the surgery, there's the risk of the anesthesia, and all these factors. There's the risk of living the rest of your life with only one kidney. Yes?
Given the fact that generally if the kidney would go, they would both go unless it's a cancer problem or a few other patients, generally anything close to renal failure would come with renal failure. And given the fact that if somebody is going to be needs a kidney, they are usually put to the top of the list. And given the fact that there is minimal risk and that pre-screening process can actually help the donor and possibly early intervention as far as it might uncover certain things that the donor did not go through yet, all those facts, do they not make it actually in any way more beneficial for the person to actually donate to the point where you might have to pay if to donate?
That's an excellent question. I haven't seen that specific analysis. It's a very interesting analysis. There are clearly benefits. But just kind of, and it's true, there have been cases of people who agreed to be donors and on the preliminary screening were found to be healthy, but when the kidney was taken out, it was found to be cancer in the kidney. Fortunately found out before the it was transplanted into the recipient. So there are beneficial aspects to it. But your point that someone who agrees to be a donor gets pushed up to the top of the list, that's not so clearly true. There are perhaps some advantages for the donor, but it's not so clearly true. In Israel, they just passed a law, and that's really, I think, the first place that passed it in a clear fashion, that if you agree to be a donor, then you receive higher preference if time comes for you to be to receive an organ, even if you haven't actually donated, even if you agree to be a donor. But your point is well taken. It's an interesting analysis. So let's move on briefly to cadaveric donation and just share with you the fundamentally different halachic approach to cadaveric donation. And then we will move on to new frontiers for just a few minutes, and then we'll open up for further questions. So cadaveric donation, the issues are fundamentally different. Now, whereas in living donation, the issue is how much risk can you accept as a living person to donate an organ? After you've died, there's no issue of risk anymore. There's no chiyuvim anymore. There's no isurim anymore because you're chafshim mitzvahs. You're no longer alive. So the donor issues are really, one, is the donor dead halachically before the harvest takes place? And that's the key issue, as we'll talk about in a moment. And these three issues, there's a chiyuv kvura of somebody after they die, there's an isur nivul ames, desecrating the body, and there's an isur hanas ames, isur deriving benefit from the body. Those are the major issues. Now the fundamental issue, which is the hot button issue, which has been discussed in the Medical Ethics Society since the inception of the Medical Ethics Society, and it has been discussed in the medical halachic world since the inception of the definition, is the whole notion of the definition of death, and a relatively new definition of what's called brain death. Just to give you a very brief overview of this in 30 seconds or less, if somebody would have 100 years ago would have sustained a massive heart attack, there would be no blood flow to the brain, the brain would stop functioning, they would stop breathing, and they would be dead. And the converse was also true. If someone had a massive stroke, and they would not be able, their brain is what usually tells the body to breathe, the brain's not telling the body to breathe, the chest cavity is not expanding, there's no oxygen coming into the body, the heart needs oxygen, without the oxygen the heart would die, within a few moments the person would be dead. Not so in the 20th and 21st century. Now with the advent of the respirator, the life support machine, whatever you want to call it, it is possible for someone to have complete brain damage, possibly even entire cessation of brain function, yet the heart could still be beating. How does that happen? Classic scenario is the following: a motor vehicle accident, usually a motorcycle accident, somebody sustains head trauma, young healthy person tragically sustains head trauma, has a massive bleed in the brain, the brain stops to function, and that person gets on the scene, EMS comes and they put the person on a respirator. They put him on the respirator, and the respirator delivers artificial oxygen to the heart. So the person could have absolutely no brain function, but the heart is still receiving oxygen and the heart is still pumping. And that individual would be diagnosed in the modern society as being brain dead. Now somebody asked, what are the criteria of brain death? Let's see if I have the criteria for you. There's a whole host of criteria. That's not the medical criteria. Here's a PET scan of the difference between normal brain and brain death. I don't know if you guys can tell the difference between the two. You know, I didn't put the criteria over here, but there are bedside criteria. That you examine the eyes, you examine the gag, you do what's called an apnea test, you determine if a person has independent respiration. So there's clinical diagnostic criteria, and then there's testing that's done with imaging, where you can actually take pictures of the brain and see if there's the functionality of the brain. But this brain death criteria has been accepted by the Western world. In the Western world, it's considered a legal definition of death. If someone sustains these criteria and is diagnosed as being brain dead by a neurologist with whatever criteria is established in that hospital, that person is considered dead, and all, you know, all support can be stopped. The question is, what does halacha say about the definition of brain death? Does halacha say that brain death is considered halachic death or not? And what's, who cares? What's the halachic nafkamina? Halachic nafkaminas are many. One, if the person's dead, can a kohen walk into the room? Can a kohen not walk into the room? If a person is brain dead, do they require kvura? Do you have to bury them immediately, or do you have to wait till the heart stops? Can that person serve as an organ donor or not? So if a person is dead, for pikuach nefesh, you can override the isser hanah, the nivul ames, and things like that. But if the person's halachically alive, you can't kill somebody in order to save somebody else's life. That's one of the things you're not allowed to do. That's one of the big three. You're not allowed to perform ritzicha to save somebody else's life. This is just an interesting thing. Take it or leave it. Most of you will probably leave it. But there's an interesting article. I'm bringing this as an interesting support to the definition of brain death. Concealed the neuroanatomy of Michelangelo's separation of light from darkness in the Sistine Chapel. So if you look up in the Sistine Chapel, I suspect some of you, or maybe none of you, have ever been within the Sistine Chapel, but in Michelangelo's extraordinary work, this actually is God in this depiction of the creation. And a couple of neuroanatomists and neurosurgeons were visiting the Sistine Chapel, and they actually noticed within the depiction of God up in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel the anatomy of the base of the brain within the depiction of God. And since Michelangelo is well versed in anatomy and he actually attended anatomical dissections, they claim it was an intentional placement of Michelangelo of the brain anatomy into the depiction of God. Take it or leave it. The prior, We're not going to discuss this now, but anyone who's interested, I'm more than happy to share with you 4,000 or 5,000 pages to read on the halachic analysis of what determines brain death and what does not. Please look fast because we're going to go through these makoros. You saw those, okay? Those which we're not going to get into discussion now. This is a Polish CPR. But suffice it to say, here's a smattering of some of the sources that deal with this. There has been thousands of pages written on this. One of the greatest machlokasim in the 20th and 21st century is whether brain death is considered halachic death or not. To this day, there are gedolei haposkim who do not accept the brain death criteria and would not allow somebody to serve as an organ donor, and there are poskim who accept the brain death criteria and would consequently allow some to be an organ donor. Here in our yeshiva, the classic debate is between Rabbi Tendler and Rabbi Bleich. Rabbi Bleich does not accept the brain death criteria. Rabbi Tendler does accept the brain death criteria, but the lines are split across the gedolei haposkim throughout the world. What I want to do for the next few minutes is just to share with you. Can I move fast? a couple of fascinating aspects of new frontiers in organ donation. I figure we'll finish around 9. Is that good? You okay? You guys okay with that? 10 more minutes? Can you handle that? I am never offended if anybody wants to leave, by the way. So fear not. If anyone needs to go or wants to go, please feel free to do so. I just want to share with you some fascinating updates in new frontiers of organ donation. One aspect is donation after cardiac death. Now, most donation takes place is harvested from patients who are brain dead. Why is that? Because the brain dead patient has a functioning circulation and the organs are receiving blood supply. So the organs are healthy. Once the heart stops beating and the blood supply stops to the organs, those organs are no longer functioning properly and the cells of the organ begin to die. And if the cells of the organ begin to die, that organ is not going to serve its purpose well when it's transplanted into somebody else. So there is a new movement to try and harvest organs after cardiac death, which in theory should appeal to all the Jews, because everybody agrees that after cardiac death, the person is halachically dead. However, there are some concerns about this halachically as well. Harvesting from people who have sustained cardiac death has a number of different categories to it. So some cases, patients that are brought in dead to the emergency room, some are unsuccessful resuscitation. Sometimes, in a scenario which is ethically problematic in the secular world and obviously in the halachic world, are people who have normal heart function and either subnormal but not brain death, who are in hospitals and are terminally ill, and the patients say, we don't want to treat them anymore, so we're going to disconnect the ventilator and let cardiac death take place. We'll have the surgeons in the operating room to harvest the organ as soon as cardiac death takes place. So that's obviously very halachically problematic. There's fascinating discussions, by the way, that when they do these procedures, when they bring the patient to the operating room, they disconnect the ventilator, first of all, sometimes the patient doesn't die. That happens, not infrequently. But in the case where the patient goes asystolic and goes flatline, how long do you wait before you harvest the organ? 30 seconds, a minute, 5 minutes, 10 minutes? Do you wait till it's irreversible? Or do you not wait till it's irreversible because you're going to harvest the organ anyway? And the longer you wait, the less likely that organ is going to be successfully transplanted into the recipient. So fascinating, complicated issues there. The other area which has received a tremendous amount of attention, both in the halachic world and the secular world, is selling an organ. Are you allowed to receive compensation to serve as a kidney donor? What do you guys think? You think it's okay to receive money to serve as a kidney donor? Why not? What's the problem? What'd you say? So issue number one is you don't own your body, right? In order to receive compensation for something, theoretically you have to own it in order to receive compensation. So there's a halachic debate about whether we own our bodies or not.
You're not necessarily selling an organ. You're getting paid for a service.
Excellent. That is exactly the halachic counterpoint. That you're not receiving compensation for an organ that belongs to you. You are simply receiving compensation for your efforts and your inconvenience and your loss of work and your medical bills. Right? And that's, in fact, the halachic response. And there are... And in the secular world, it is currently illegal to sell organs. But if from a halachic perspective, and it just shows, by the way, the exploitation. So here's one case from April of last year. Five people charged after Chinese teen sells his kidney to buy an iPhone. So a 17-year-old kid wanted to buy an iPhone in China, so he sold his kidney to be able to afford an iPhone. So that's obviously a form of... actually, it was a tablet, too. So it was an iPhone plus tablet. Just kidding. And there are those who claim that that donation has to be altruistic. And the secular world believes in that. But we in the halachic world don't necessarily believe that. That, you know, mitzvah is done the shalolishma, mitoch shalolishma balishma. You have no chiv to, it doesn't necessarily have to be altruistic. And in fact, Rav Eliashiv, Rav Shlomo Zalman actually, this is not the quote, but Rav Shlomo Zalman said that even if a person says, I am donating this kidney and I have no intention whatsoever to serve as a kidney donor except to receive the money, and it's the only reason I'm doing this, I would never do this otherwise, it is absolutely mutter for him to serve as a donor. Basically, the short answer in terms of what halacha has to say about selling organs is that it is absolutely... Here, this one's for you guys. Okay. Yeah, you got to sell both kidneys for that one. And let me just finish up. So here's the ownership of the body issue. But the bottom line is all the issues that are raised are all solved. You talk about selling a kidney. This is another one. Selling a kidney to buy an apartment. This, somebody asked Rav Eliashiv if he could sell a kidney in order to be able to afford an apartment for his son-in-law. But but just to this is a fascinating question. Can you donate a kidney al manas to take it back if you need it? Right? So let's say you say I'm happy to donate a kidney, but if I need it back, I want it back. So there actually in this psak, the answer was that you may indeed be able to do that. Surprisingly enough, and I just want to share before we close. I'm sorry for whipping through these. Don't look. Nobody look at any of these. I just want to spend the last 5 minutes on the following really exciting new frontier: organ donation. Until this point, basically for the last few decades, since cornea donation, kidney donation, liver donation, lung donation, has really only included vital organs. Organs that you need to live. You can't live without a heart, you can't live without a liver, you can't live without a lung. But now the latest frontier is what's called non-vital organ transplant. So for example, there's been a case of a larynx transplant. So I always like to joke, larynx is the voice box. So if you transplanted a female larynx into a man, would that be Kol Isha? There have been actually uterus transplants. It used to be just a matter of fiction, but now there have been actually two or three uterine transplants. And there has been, which you may have heard in the news just over the last day or two, another non-vital organ transplant is hand or arm transplant. And then just, this is from, yesterday. What is today? Is today the 29th or the 30th? So it's today. It's today. Sorry I couldn't get anything more recent for you. I apologize. The Staten Island soldier had a double arm transplant. This tragic case of this soldier, he lost all his extremities in a bomb in Iraq, and they transplanted two arms to him, and he has, these are both transplanted arms. So the halachic issues that relate to these are can be extrapolated from the halachic issues of vital transplant. You know, is it okay for him to undergo such a risky procedure for something which is not life-saving per se? For something which is just enhancing, especially now that prosthetic limbs are so successful. Did you have a question?
Is he able to use his hand?
Yes, yes. Actually, in the press conference, I didn't include the video, he was lifting up his hand and he is straightening out his yarmulke. You can see. there have been face transplants, larynx transplants. This is a case of the first womb transplant, which took place in 2011. And actually, just this past year, I haven't seen the follow-up on this, they transferred an embryo into that first uterine transplant recipient. So here's a halachic shaila to ponder as we close, the issue of pidyon haben. So think of this. If a woman had a firstborn child while she was alive, then she donated her uterus to this woman, and this woman is now giving birth to a male child. Does that child from this birth require a pidyon haben or not?
Doesn't it say the first to open the womb?
Ah, so it's the peter rechem. So this, if you focus on the womb, this womb already had a peter rechem.
Right.
But if you focus on the woman, this woman never had a peter rechem before. Right, so it's a shaila, first of all, is it mutter to donate a uterus or not? But the truth is, the solution is a medical solution, that it, all these cases of uterine transplantation, they would never do a normal delivery, they would always do a cesarean section, and cesarean section, there's no chiyuv of pidyon haben. So we'll, but here's the part, this one is for the women in the audience. The uterus transplant was a success, I'm sure you'll find your husband much more understanding now. But just to conclude, we've had an opportunity to discuss a lot of issues, and you can see there's a lot of issues we didn't have a chance to discuss. Mitzvah Hashem, we'll have other opportunities, but at least we gave you a little understanding of living organ donation and cadaveric donation, what the medical issues are, what the halachic issues are, and a brief glimpse into the future of organ transplantation. I'm happy to answer any questions you have either now, or you can take my email and later.
Before questions begin, I just want to let you know what you need. We are very blessed to have with us someone, a friend of mine, who has actually donated bone marrow and has volunteered to speak after the questions for a little bit and answer questions on donating bone marrow with his experience, whatever you'd like to ask.
Excellent. Excellent. Great. Yes. So people generally, if they're a mumar, maybe. But if they're not a mumar, people are not mechalik between observant and not observant. But excellent question, yes. Reacha b'mitzvos means someone who is obligated as yourself. If we'd look into all our observance, even, you know, it'd be a very sticky thing. You know, you got to get an interview before you agree to donate to someone. I don't know if we'd all pass that test. Yes?
Is this Elijah?
For anyone who's interested in the slideshow, I'm happy to share freely. No need to use my name if you want to use anything. But I can give it to Yosef or to Mordechai or to Esti, and you guys can have any of the slides you want and use them in any way you want. Yes?
Does that include children and women?
Excellent question. Yes. Yes. Because they are obligated as the Torah would obligate them. Now, children is a very complex issue, which we didn't talk about. An entire discussion about whether children can serve as organ donors, whether they can consent to organ donation or not. A major machlokas aposkim. So take the following scenario. And there's a difference between bone marrow and kidneys. So there had been cases where there's a woman who suffers from leukemia, and the only possible bone marrow donor is her 2-year-old child. Are you allowed to harvest bone marrow from a child? So that child has no chiyuv mitzvahs, right? Now there is a notion of zachin la'adam shelo b'fanav. You're mezakeh somebody for something which they would find beneficial. And some people say that, you know, to benefit that child in this way would be extraordinary, because the child obviously wants to grow up with a mother. And the contrary, if you deny that child the opportunity and that child grows up and knows that the opportunity was denied them, they might also resent that for the rest of their life. But let's say that child wants to be a kidney donor. where we allow that level of risk. So there's some posts going to say absolutely not under no circumstances. So, I mean, but it's a longer discussion. Right. Right. So this is not your low befunov. This is befunov when you're doing the surgery. You can't get more befunov than that. Yes. Any other questions? Yes. Please. In terms of selling,
yes.
Right. So excellent question. It's not even so clear. The analysis is not clear whether on the aggregate there would be more donation or not. So some people say you would poison altruistic giving in general, and it would be detrimental to society if you converted all of organ donation to a commodity. So blood is a compensation. Correct. Correct, but they feel that kidneys would be a different level. And all the points are arguable. All the points are arguable. And some say, you know, who cares? Bottom line, at the end of the day, you're going to save more aggregate lives than without selling. So you know that some people do argue that. And in fact, while it's illegal now, it's quite possible that in 5-10 years from now, that law will be stricken from the books, and it probably will be legal to receive some form of compensation, either in tax credit. Or a payment for burial, or a whole host of other things. Yes. Money. Receive money. No, people receive money for it's also halachically permissible to receive financial compensation for receiving blood. The other thing where people receive compensation in donating the body part. What's the most famous one? Donating sperm and eggs. There's huge compensation for egg donation. It's thousands of dollars. So there's, and that's allowed, right? So if you're going to allow from that, the difference with all these things, with blood, bone marrow, and gametes, is that they regenerate. So if they regenerate, it's a different story than giving away a part, which is a non-regeneratable part. Yes? How much time do we have? We got another couple hours? Yes and no. I mean, generally, donating anonymously, definitely usser. And donating male zera has, you know, unless there's a specific hume for revu and a specific purpose, you know, it's complicated and would require halachic analysis. Eggs is less halachically problematic than male zera. Yes?
A lot of college students tend to prefer the idea of being an organ donor, having it on their license, I'm an organ donor. How does that fit into this whole discussion?
So with respect to donating, there's different, there's cadaveric donation and there's living donation. So the organ donor card on the back of your license is really intended for cadaveric donation. That's, God forbid, someone's in an accident, not able to speak, you don't know their wishes, you would look at their organ donor card and see if they wanted to donate an organ. So that hinges on the key question of whether you accept the brain death criteria or not, because the majority of these organs would be harvested in a case when brain death was the diagnosis. I want to make it very clear that brain death only happens to a very small percentage of people. It's not like everybody, the natural course of the human being is that brain death precedes cardiac death. That's not the case. The overall majority of people who leave this world sustain cardiac death. A very small percentage of people sustain brain death or develop brain death. But it's those patients that would be serving as an organ donor. So the question, bottom line, can you halachically serve as an organ donor or not? It's going to depend on your posek, on whether your posek accepts the brain death criteria or not. Yes?
So generally the cases that you were talking about was where there was something over at the cold and it was become the funny, where you know that A is sick and B can do an organ, stem cell, whatever it is, to heal them. Now, very often, for example, you have bone marrow like outside, right? You don't know if you're a match for someone, you can measure and find out, but how much of a, even if there's a field when
Excellent. So what you are referring to, the notion of chol lefaneinu, is invoked if there are isurim which you're going to be over on. So if you're going to be over on the Isser of Hanas Ameis, Nivul Ameis, things like that, you can only be over on those if there is an immediate and direct benefit or beneficiary to those violation of Isurim, which would be the case in organ donation, because there are always people on the list. There's 130,000 people on the list right now, you know, as we speak. Ask Ari to look it up. How many people on the list? But bone marrow donation is no Isser. It's only positive. There's no Isser. It's a mitzvah lo samar al dam reyecha that you could potentially save somebody's life. So that you don't even invoke the chol lefoneinu in there. That's not even invoked. It's not part of the analysis.
Do you feel that it would be a chiyuv to register?
I would say it's as close to chiyuv as possible. I think to come out and say it's an absolute chiyuv, no. I personally think that every member of the entire Jewish community should be on the registry. I can't see a single reason why not. I think it should be instituted, you know, maybe not as part of your driver's license, but maybe like, you know, I don't remember what the limit is, like 16, I think you have to be 16 to donate or 17 to donate, but I think on whatever birthday that is that you reach, I think it should be institutionalized that you should, you know, as part of your birthday gifts, you should receive a swab. and every person should be part of the registry. I can't see a single reason why every human being should not be part of that registry. Not one reason why not. Yes? The donor or the recipient? It's going to make a difference whether they'll accept the kidney, whether the person has other diabetes or hypertension or a whole host of other things. And actually, you know what? I'm happy to answer all your questions, whether you know either tonight or afterwards. But I want to give an opportunity to the person that wanted to speak to do that, because I think that's extremely important.
Just before we introduce him, obviously, thank you to Reverend Dr. Brooks for coming. We also wanted to thank the two board members who actually ran this entire event, S.T. Robin, Yosef, Yitzhak Pink, this is all in the back over there.
Woo!
Wonderful event. And Ariel Kaplan, is that what it is? Come on.
Is there a way to borrow this? I guess we've already heard